are some 60 cantos, 60 cantos in the making.
These pageants that Ron described are extraordinarily important. For one thing, they bring to a kind of climax the ritual nature that we've seen throughout the Purgatorio. Whether it was simply something like the singing of a hymn together, we followed the use of ritual all the way through. Now it really comes to a kind of ritual sound and light show. It really is spectacular. And before Dante meets Beatrice, the first of these great pageants takes place, a procession that involves symbolically figures that represent all of Scripture. It's more complicated than that, but it begins with that. For example, he sees seven candlesticks, an image from the book of Revelation, that have symbolic values of the gifts of the Holy Spirit. Then he sees 24 elders who represent, by a particular way of reckoning, the entire Old Testament. It can be divided up so there are 24 books, for example, counting the 12 minor prophets as one book. And then comes a great chariot. And the figure that draws this chariot is described as a griffin. Griffin's an interesting classical animal. It is half lion and half eagle. But here, clearly, it represents Christ, who, after all, is also a combination of two natures, human and divine. At either wheel of the chariot, we have women who represent the virtues. We have them representing the virtues that have been passed down through classical antiquity, the cardinal virtues, prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude. And then at the other wheel are those specifically Christian virtues of faith, hope, and love, the so-called theological virtues. One of the most spectacular parts of the description of this procession is four beasts covered with eyes, an image that comes from the book of Revelation and before that from the book of Ezekiel in the Old Testament. And Christians had for a long time likened these four beasts to the four evangelists. And so we have that representation and then figures that represent as well all the other books of the New Testament, including in various ways. John appears three times, once as the fourth gospel, once as the author of letters, and once as the author of the book of Revelation. So it's not a historical collection of folks, because of course all the writers of these scriptures are in paradise, but rather this highly symbolic pageant. And after Dante meets Beatrice, we're going to come back to this and have a kind of historical pageant that's going to reenact the entire history of the church.
One way to take a look at the pageant, in addition to what Bill says, is that it's sort of a kind of fanfare for the arrival of Beatrice. You want to make it as spectacular an entrance as you can. But it's interesting if you think about that, because in order to do this, Dante draws on symbols which are very public. Okay, they are symbols that have come over the centuries to represent the church. And at the end of all of this, we get Beatrice, who is somebody who really has a very private and personal relationship to the pilgrim. It's very different, for example, from having Virgil the poet as his first guide, because Beatrice is somebody who Dante meets, falls in love with, and writes poetry for when he is a young man. She dies and now comes back to be his guide. But if it weren't for Dante's poem, Beatrice really wouldn't exist in our imagination. There really is very little in terms of record of her life, and in any case, that record would be irrelevant without the use that Dante makes of her life. So what's sort of interesting to think about is this amazing juxtaposition of public, the church as it has existed, okay, sort of in the mind of God, and then you have Beatrice coming at the end of all of this. So it suggests something like this, I think, that what the church is to all of us, a kind of means to salvation, Beatrice is individually to Dante, that she represents, among other things, a kind of special grace that is granted to the pilgrim to be his guide now. And of course, that takes us all the way back to what we saw earlier in the poem, when we found out that Beatrice was the one who was sort of the emissary from heaven to Virgil. Okay, so one part of her job is over, and now she takes over personally. But you have in this extraordinary public demonstration, this public play that really is put on for Dante, you have the appearance of his personal muse now become his personal guide, now become something of his personal savior.
All the way back in line one of Canto One of Inferno, we talked about how for Dante, this poem is both very personal and universal. And as Ron suggests, this comes together here. And let me just use a little bit different language to say what Ron said as a way of illuminating his comments. First of all, of course, we believe, Christians believe, that God's grace, the offer of salvation, is universal. It's made to everyone. However, the way God offers grace is, in a sense, very much tailored to who we are, what we will listen to, what we need. And so it may be that grace is offered not just to Dante, but to everybody. But how does God reach Dante? Or to put it in a very special language, how does God condescend to Dante? And of course, we know that he sends his great poetic mentor, Virgil, and then this, as Ron said, this sort of private love, Beatrice, because this is the way that God reaches Dante. Grace universal, the form of grace very much tailored by God to meet the needs of the person who is given then the opportunity to respond to God's grace.
The language that describes the actual entrance of Beatrice is really amazing even by Dante's standards. He throws in a bunch of Latin taglines along with the Italian, and those Latin taglines, most of them come from the Bible and from sections of the Bible that are used in the Christian liturgy. Okay, so that the language goes something like this. At that final summons, all the blessed will rise out of their graves, ready to raise new-bodied voices, singing hallelujah. Just so rose up above the heavenly cart 100 spirits, ad vocem tante sanis, Latin tagline, eternal heralds, ministers of God, all shouting, benedictus qui venis. Then, tossing a rain of flowers in the air, manibus odate lilia plenis. I want to just take a look at those last two, benedictus qui venis in English, blessed are you who come. It's a slight variation of a line that's used in the liturgy, in the Mass, right before the consecration is going to take place. Well, what it's doing once again is suggesting all of the religious Christian overtones of Beatrice's appearance here, that sense that she's coming as a kind of Christ figure to Dante. But then the next line is a quotation from Virgil's Aeneid, manibus odate lilia plenis. Turns out that that's a line that we talked about when we talked about Virgil a little bit earlier, that is to say, in our very first lectures, this sense that the whole of Roman history is presented to Aeneas in Book 6. This is part of that particular pageant, and it's all about somebody who, a nephew of Augustus, who didn't make it, who died young. And as a kind of valedictory for him, they say this line, which means scatter lilies with full hands. So in Virgil, it's being used to sort of talk about how tragedy is built into the nature of human existence. Here, in Dante's poem, it's used to sort of strew the ground with lilies for the coming of Beatrice, who is the one, more than anybody else, who turns this poem from a tragedy into a comedy. And indeed, in some ways, this is a very good example of what we talked about earlier when we said that Dante in this poem is rewriting the story of Dido and Aeneas and making it a kind of comedy with the new characters being Beatrice and Dante. So the coming of Beatrice is described in language that comes from Virgil, which is a very interesting thing, given what happens immediately after.
Beatrice finally arrives, clothed in three colors, colors we've already talked about that have been used in purgatory to represent the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love, that is to say white, green, and red, the colors of the three steps at the entrance to purgatory proper in Purgatory 9. And then Dante is so kind of blown away by all this, he turns around to consult his guide. He turns around to say to Virgil, and this is Dante speaking, "Not one drop of blood is left inside my veins that does not throb. I recognize signs of the ancient flame." An interesting line, because it refers to a line in Virgil's Aeneid where Dido sees Aeneas and feels the ancient flame. Remember, she had been married, her husband was dead, she had pledged her faith to the ashes of Sychaeus, but she feels the signs of the ancient flame. And then, one of the great lines, "But Virgil was not there." That as Beatrice comes, Virgil disappears. That this is the handing off of Dante. It is now time for Beatrice. Virgil has done everything Virgil can do for Dante, and now Dante must have another guide.
Notice, of course, that what Dante the poet is achieving here is that in the very last appearance of Virgil, and then in the disappearance of Virgil, he's paying tribute to Virgil by using lines from Virgil. In other words, he's using Virgil's poem to talk about the disappearance of Virgil, which is a really wonderful, wonderful rhetorical trick. Now, it's sort of interesting that there is Dante stunned at the loss of Virgil, and Beatrice essentially doesn't give him time to do any serious mourning for him. What she does is immediately begin her association with Dante by speaking to him very sternly. And what you get is this beginning of Beatrice essentially taking Dante to task for all of the things that he has done and failed to do in his life. This becomes a sort of crucial moment in the poem for Dante, because he has to account for himself and account for his life up until now to Beatrice. So that part of her function as Dante's guide here is to be a kind of stern judge. And it would seem sort of interesting that, you know, she doesn't come sort of as a comforter or as a consoler. She comes first as judge and accuses him of all kinds of things, including a kind of infidelity to her since the time that she died, and strongly suggests that what Dante has done has been to sort of use her in some of the wrong ways when she was still alive on earth, and more important, after she dies.
"Dante, though Virgil leaves you, do not weep. Not yet, that is, for you shall have to weep from yet another wound. Do not weep yet." This is not the lovey-dovey, let's give each other a hug for old time's sake greeting. It is the only time in the entire poem that Dante's name appears. He's referred to in a lot of different ways when he and Virgil chat, for example. This is the only time the proper name Dante appears, and it's her first word. She just bangs it out at him, and we're ready to take a very careful look at Dante's life, as Ron suggests, from her perspective. For example, as she continues her discussion, "Not only through the working of the spheres, which brings each seed to its appropriate end according as the stars keep company," we talked about that back in the middle parts of the purgatory, "but also through the bounty of God's grace, raising from vapors born so high above they cannot be discerned by human sight, was this man so endowed potentially in early youth, had he allowed his gifts to bloom, he would have reaped abundantly." Dante, you're a really talented guy. The spheres and God's grace have put in you this extraordinary potential. And now, sort of wagging your finger, why'd you blow it? Why'd you screw up? Why is that potential so unfulfilled in you?
And what happens, of course, is that she particularly says, look, one of the ways in which you can define this failure to do what you should have is that, she says, "when I passed into my second age and changed my life for life, when I died and went to heaven, that man you see," sort of the court there that's all assembled, Dante, that guy that she named, "strayed after others and abandoned me." Well, that's a highly charged line because, of course, remember that the whole story of Aeneas and Dido is that Aeneas deserts Dido and then she dies. She kills herself. What Beatrice is saying is Dante has deserted Beatrice after she dies. But, of course, in the Virgilian version of the story, when Dido kills herself, that's it. That's the end of the story. No reconciliation in the underworld. And in fact, pointedly, there's a lack of reconciliation when they meet in the underworld. Here, in the rewriting of the story, according to Dante, the poet, when they meet in the afterlife, Dante gets a second chance. And the second chance is really contingent on his own repentance and his recognition of what his sins were. Now, notice that what she accuses him of course, is a straying after others and abandoning her. Well, one way to take a look at it is, you know, just fairly literally in the sense that he went after other women. And given the way that he responded, let's say, when we were doing the Francesca canto, there's no reason to assume that maybe that wasn't literally true. But it also seems that in context, what this is also about is Dante finding lesser things to give himself to, finding causes and finding programs that were not appropriate to his talents and that were going to lead to blind alleys anyway. And so that accusation seems to me to be a very strong one here. What she says is that he wandered from the path that leads to truth. Wow, that sounds an awful lot like the opening of the poem, all right? And he was pursuing simulacra of the good, things that looked like they were the real deal but weren't. And so that's what she accuses Dante of here.
She rephrases it a little bit later. You never saw in nature or in art a beauty like the beauty of my form. I was physically beautiful, she says, which clothed me once and now is turned to dust. Okay, where is that beautiful form? It's all sitting there in a grave somewhere in Florence, turned to dust. And if that perfect beauty, perfect physical beauty, disappeared when I departed from the world, how could another mortal object lure your love? Dante, this was the big all-time lesson. Physical things don't last forever. It is in the nature of physical things, and not just physical objects, but worldly goals, political power, fame, whatever it might be. All of those things are in fact subject to change and decay and destruction. And when you saw the most beautiful physical thing of all turn to dust, shouldn't that have told you to reorient yourself toward only the very highest things, those things that last forever? But no, you went leaping after other mortal things, whether, as Ron said, it was another physical person or whether it was money or political power or fame or whatever it might be. How could you have done that? How could you have totally missed the lesson you should have drawn from my demise?
So what's Dante's choice at this time? I suppose most of us faced with the same sort of accusation would immediately go into our defensive mode and talk about all of the ways in which, well, it really wasn't totally my fault. And I did some good things there and so on. But remember, this is Dante who has seen the consequences of that kind of defensiveness, the consequences of that kind of putting the blame off on somebody else. It's called hell. And everybody that he saw back there had that same kind of, hey, it wasn't my fault. The book made me do it. The Pope made me do it. Envy made them do it to me. So what Dante does is reject that choice and essentially confess. All right. Have a moment of conversion here. A canto, in other words, where what we see is Dante accepting who he is and therefore able to go on as somebody else. It's sort of interesting the way in which the language portrays this. My fear and deep chagrin between them, Dante speaking in the first person, forced out of my mouth a miserable Yes. Only by ears and eyes, only by ears with eyes could it be heard. Okay? Dante now is a changed person and is willing to put up with more of Beatrice's sort of specifics about, look, how did you go wrong? Because he really sees that confession is a necessary part of his journey from this time forward.
And one of the questions that immediately comes up is, if Dante is indeed confessed, if Dante is indeed prepared to go to heaven as a still living person, what's going to come next? How is this reorientation that Beatrice had to choose him out about, how is this reorientation going to change his life? Well, one of the things Beatrice begins to do, it will be laid out more specifically and in more detail in the Paradiso, and therefore this is a kind of preview of what we're going to hear, is this. The circle of the seven nymphs now formed a cloister for the lady. In their hands they held those lights no wind on earth could quench. A short time you shall dwell outside the walls, then you with me shall live eternally, citizen of that Rome where Christ is a Roman. Very interesting line. Now, for the good of sinners in your world, observe the chariot well, and what you see, put into writing when you have returned. You're about to see pageant number two. Now, this is not the complete commission yet to write the Commedia. Again, Dante will receive that in paradise. But Dante's journey, we now begin to see, has a function beyond his personal salvation. You got to get the personal salvation stuff right first. But to what goal? Of course, to save Dante's soul. But there is, as always, this public as well as private dimension to anything that to us seems often completely private. And Beatrice here begins to lay out what another purpose beyond Dante's personal salvation is in taking this journey, to go back and help other sinners back in the world by writing when this journey has been completed.
Second pageant turns out also to be related to the church, but if the first one was sort of the church as it exists in the mind of God, the idea of the church, the second one is about the church as it actually has existed in time. There's a tradition drawn mostly from the exegesis of the book of Revelation, which sees the history of the church falling into seven different ages, starting, of course, with Christ's incarnation, ending with the Last Judgment, parallel to the idea that the world itself, starting with creation and going to Last Judgment, has seven ages. And the seven ages of the church are usually marked by particular crises or particular problems that the church has endured. And that's the tradition that kind of generates this pageant. That's the tradition that informs it, as what Dante sees in front of him is this depiction of the various tribulations that have taken place in the church from early times, not only up to the present, but predicting what's going to be to go beyond the present all the way to the last times.
Obviously, there's no time here to summarize these seven ages. Simply to say this, in the early phases of pageant number two, we have an attack on the cart, on this chariot, which represents the church, that stands for Roman persecution, the persecution of Nero, for example. And then comes a second attack, which is divisions within the church, that is to say, the early heresies of the church. I want to focus for a minute, though, on this third age and what characterized it. Once more, the eagle, the symbol of the Roman Empire, it had first swooped down to attack the church. Once more, the eagle swooped down through the tree, this time into the framework of the car to shed some of its golden feathers there. Not to sort of hack away at it, if you will, but to deposit golden feathers. This is a reference to the time of the Emperor Constantine. We had a reference to this same set of events in the age of Constantine all the way back in Inferno 19. O Constantine, what evil marked the hour not of your conversion, but when you bestowed wealth and political power on the church. That's what's being represented here. when Constantine, the first Christian emperor, bestowed wealth and political authority on the church, that turned out to be a great crisis. Now, you know, we've seen Constantine attacked for things he did, or at least the consequences of things he did, several times, and we're going to see it again in the Paradiso before we meet Constantine in heaven. But here again is the reference to the fact that this event, this changing of the relationship between church and state so that the state bestows wealth and power on the church, is extraordinarily significant. The consequences are being felt in Florence, in Rome, 1,000 years later.
And of course, that's a way of thinking about why this might be some use to Dante, because it's sort of giving him a framework, an outline of Christian history, which therefore can be used as a kind of key so that he can unlock the story, get into the story, and become part of the story. Which is to say, Dante now has a framework. When he actually does receive a more specific commission in Paradiso, he has sort of the large outline there and sees how the story of his own time fits into this larger story of Christian history from its beginnings all the way to the endings. In other words, he sees that he is part of a larger story in these final cantos, even as he sees that this doesn't take away from the personal importance of his own conversion, of his own relationship with Beatrice, and of this relationship as a kind of means to salvation for him. So once again, what we have is this wonderful juxtaposition and balance between the personal and the universal. And the cantos at the end of Purgatory just do a wonderful and magnificent job of bringing together personal and political, personal, and theological, personal and universal, in a way that speaks to the nature of the entire poem.
And as Ron suggested, he not only looks all the way to the present, but beyond. For example, here, remember the poem set in 1300, although Dante writes it several years later, he predicts in this pageant the movement of the papacy from Rome to Avignon, what we call the Babylonian captivity of the church. This, of course, now parallels what he said further back in Purgatory about the abandonment of Rome by the Holy Roman Emperor, who's living in Germany. Now we're told that in a few years, the Pope is going to abandon Rome and move to Avignon so that Rome will be totally lost of the folks who are supposed to be there, the center of the world, where together they should rule the world in peace and in a way that will bring salvation to the maximum number of people.
Purgatorio ends, "From these holiest waters I return to her reborn." Dante goes through a kind of baptismal and purification ritual. "A tree renewed in bloom with newborn foliage, immaculate, eager to rise, now ready for the stars." And that journey to the stars will become the subject of our next lectures as we get to paradise.
Lecture 18, Ascending the Spheres.
We've come a long way. Let's remember that we began in Canto 1 of Inferno in the dark wood of error. And although our goal was the light, as it turns out, Dante couldn't get directly to the light. There were these beasts that stopped him from climbing toward the light. And Dante was then told he had to take another way. That way, of course, involved going literally to the center of the earth through all of hell, and then climbing the seven-story mountain and arriving in the earthly paradise. Only after all of this was Dante able to go to that place of light that he sought unsuccessfully at the beginning of the poem. And this is an important thing to remember, that we finally are going to begin that exploration and experience of heaven. It's interesting that in the second canto of Paradiso, Dante sort of gives his readers a warning. All you who in your wish to hear my words have followed thus far in your little boat behind my ship that's singing sails these waters, go back now while you can still see your shores. Do not attempt the deep. It well could be that losing me, you would be lost yourselves. But then he also invites us. Those few of you who from your youth have raised your eager mouths in search of angels' bread on which man feeds here, always hungering, you may indeed allow your boat to sail the high seas in the furrow of my wake, ahead of parted waters that flow back. It may seem like, in one sense, we've arrived. The hard work has been done. The visiting of hell, the climbing of the seven-story mountain. But Dante the poet and Dante the pilgrim and the readers of this poem must all prepare themselves. This is going to be tough. It's going to be intellectually challenging. It's going to be spiritually demanding. Dante's ready. Dante raises the question, we need to make sure we're ready too if we're going to profit from sailing behind Dante's boat.
I want to point out in the passage that Bill just read that if we're not ready, it seems like what he's suggesting is that the kind of journey that we would take would be the kind of journey that led to Ulysses' death. In other words, the very language here suggests that what we're doing in the Paradiso is Ulysses done right. And what we're going to try and do in these lectures is suggest some of the things that will help us do it right in what is, in some ways, the most difficult part of the Commedia. And I think we'd like to say just a little bit about why that is the case. Let's start with the fact that in Paradiso, according to Orthodox Christian theology, what you have are souls who are busy in contemplation of God, and that contemplation really consists of their eternal bliss. Well, by definition, that activity, if that's the right word, turns out to be outside of space and time. But of course, by the very fact that this is a poet writing about something, has a beginning and a middle and an end, we're in space and time. So how can Dante the poet sort of figure, talk about, describe activities that are outside of space and time? And what he does is a very ingenious thing that enables him to make this part of his journey parallel to the other parts, in that it also consists of the encounter that the pilgrim has with souls in the afterlife, but of course this part of the afterlife, the place which is the dwelling of the blessed. What he does is to take the Ptolemaic universe as it was then understood in his own time, that is to say the universe as seen from the vantage point of Earth. What you have moving out turns out to be first the moon, then Mercury, then Venus, then the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Seven planets, as they were called. And what he does is make each of those planets the temporary dwelling place for souls that he encounters on this upward journey. We're told early on, in fact, that the souls aren't really there. They're really surrounding the throne of God in eternal bliss, but they make themselves available for the interview with Dante. Moreover, what he does is use those planets in terms of traditional associations that they had with virtues and vices, so that, well, with virtues in this case, so that each of the souls that he finds and talks to and encounters turns out to represent a particular virtue, either by fulfilling that virtue in their life back on Earth or by a lack of that virtue. And so what he's able to do is structure things so that, in fact, what the pilgrim does in this part of the Commedia is exactly what the pilgrim did in the other parts of the Commedia, that is to say, encounter souls, have a kind of discourse with them, and learn from them. The overwhelmingly big difference, of course, is that here the souls that he meets turn out to be folks who have positive things to teach him, that they are positive rather than negative examples. And so what we'll see is in that way similar to what we've seen before, but of course the manner of of journey is very different, because Dante is ascending sort of weightless and almost bodiless through the spheres. And so we have this huge difference, but at the same time, the basic structure of the Paradiso remains similar to the other two canticles.
I want to say something that builds on what Ron said regarding how Dante sees these souls in heaven. As he said, they aren't really there in these spheres. And Dante takes some time out to explain why they appear to him in this way. In other words, is this some sort of mechanism that Dante's just sort of all dreamed up all by himself, or does this actually fit into a tradition? Dante, of course, argues the latter for this same reason, that is to say, the limited understanding and perception of people. For this same reason, Scripture condescends to your intelligence, attributing with other meaning hands and feet to God. And Holy Church presents to you archangels with human features, Gabriel and Michael, and that one who made Tobit see again. That Dante is placing his journey to heaven, therefore, in a tradition. This is what we experience on earth every day. God doesn't, in a physical way, have hands and feet, but the Bible uses that language so that we can understand. Angels don't really have feathers, but we describe them as physical beings because we need some point of reference in order to understand what an angel is. So that Dante is saying that what is happening to him in heaven happens to all of us all the time from the same source, God's condescension, without any of the negative sense of that word, God descending to be with human beings.
Notice also what that implies is that the souls themselves are going to be speaking to Dante at Dante's own level. And so we can see that this makes things intelligible to the pilgrim and so on. But the other side of that coin is that by this time, they expect that Dante's level is pretty high. In other words, having come this far through Inferno and through Purgatorio, the discourses that the souls have with Dante are often at a very sophisticated level. They talk about theology and philosophy and politics, all the stuff that we were talking about in the other two canticles, but they do it to a pilgrim that they expect by this time knows something. That Dante is still learning goes without saying. He's learning from them, but they expect him to be starting at a much higher base, really, that this is advanced discourses in all of these things. And so that enables the poet to pick up major themes, issues, and discussions that he's had earlier, but pick them up at a higher level. And very often it's stated very explicitly, you know more now, we're going to make it tougher.
Yeah, I was going to say, and that's also true not just for Dante the Pilgrim, but for us. Just as Dante has been through hell and purgatory, we've been through 67 cantos. And we need to have not exactly a catalog in our head, but we need to remember those events, those encounters, those lessons that Dante learned, because everything in paradise is going to build on them, and everything the poet does is going to, as Ron suggests, refer time and time again in sometimes clear and sometimes extraordinarily subtle ways to everything we've talked about in the first set of lectures up to now, and also a lot of things that we didn't have time to deal with.
And again, to make this explicit in terms of what the modern reader goes through in dealing with the Paradiso, one of the problems traditionally is that Paradiso is tough and often seen as too tough for readers who have done pretty well with Inferno and maybe with Purgatorio as well. What we're trying to suggest, I think, is that, yeah, you're right, it is tougher than the other parts, but in fact, all of the stuff that you need has already been given to you if you've been following the journey with Dante. The passage that Bill began with, where we're sort of being warned away unless we're ready to do this in a kind of serious way, I think says both the positive and negative aspects. We're being warned away from just sort of being casual in this. Right. If we want to read things, let's say, the way Francesca read back in Canto 5 of Inferno, it's not going to do us any good at all here. But if we're willing to be serious, there's an awful lot to be gained from taking the journey along with Dante.
I would make one more point before we go right to the beginning of the Paradiso, and that is, we might expect in this poem that it's going to be very highly theological. It is. and that it's going to deal with personal salvation. It does. And that it's going to deal with the most mysterious elements of Christian theology. It does. But it's not going to abandon the concern with politics, universally, in Italy, in Florence. It's not going to divorce itself from those earthly concerns that we're going to hear about politics, about the papacy, about poetry. All the topics we've dealt with that in some ways sound to us worldly are going to be discussed, but again, from a different and broader perspective than in Inferno and Purgatory. So we're going to find a lot that's new, but we're also going to get Dante's final offer on all the topics that we've been dealing with all the way through the poem.
Okay, with that, let's go to the beginning of the Paradiso. The glory of the one who moves all things penetrates all the universe, reflecting in one part more and in another less. I have been in his brightest shining heaven and seen such things that no man, once returned from there, has wit or skill to tell about. For when our intellect draws near its goal and fathoms to the depths of its desire, the memory is powerless to follow. But still, as much as heaven's holy realm as I could store and treasure in my mind shall now become the subject of my song. Well, this is a pretty dense passage, and it seems to me that it tells us a whole lot about what's going to come. One of the most important things that it tells us is that when you get to a place that is beyond space and time, your ability to remember is going to be somewhat limited. Remember, the fiction is that Dante is simply the pilgrim, a reporter telling us what he has seen, but here he gets to a point where what he has seen is really beyond the power of language to reproduce very well. So in a sense, it's a kind of apology at the beginning, saying this is not my vision of Paradiso. This is what I remember of my trip to Paradiso, which turns out not to be the same thing. It talks about the limits of memory, and over and over and over again, what's called by the critics the ineffability topos, that is to say, the inability for description to reach reality, becomes one of the major themes of the Paradiso. So that in various ways, Dante tells us of this, including all of the statements that he makes in the Paradiso about what kind of language is appropriate or available for this kind of journey.
Sometimes when people look back on Inferno, Dante's language seems very coarse. We would say even a few four-letter words and whatever. And there are sometimes people who are put off, or if it's taught to younger students, they sort of want to white out a word or two. The development of language in this poem is one of the extraordinary themes of it, because we have that language giving way to a different sort of language in the Paradiso, in the Purgatory, and that giving way to still another kind of language. And here we see that Dante, in very conscious ways, not only tries to press the language, but also to expand the language while at the same time recognizing the limitations of language. For example, there are many new words. Dante makes them up in the Paradiso. The first one appears, in fact, in Canto 1. He calls on us that we have to be transhumanized. We have to be taken beyond the human. The word itself is Dante's invention as he expands the language. But at the same time, he says that transhumanized, it cannot be explained per verba. It cannot be explained in words. That ultimately, the word, like transhumanized, must give way to our need to experience things. It's not enough that we read. It's not enough that we understand. That Dante is going to experience the presence of God and the light of God in this poem. And so too must we not just be readers, albeit of this exalted and expanded language. We must also join in the experiential element of Dante's journey.
And in fact, in that very passage that Bill is quoting from, it turns out that Dante is using and transforming a classical text, a myth taken from Ovid's Metamorphoses. With the absence of Virgil as Dante's direct guide, in the Paradiso, Dante draws from other classical writers, and none more important than Ovid. Well, in this particular example, he sort of has a comparison. He says, gazing at her, that is to say, the transformation that he feels when he's looking directly at Beatrice, I felt myself becoming what Glaucus had become, tasting the herb that made him like the other sea gods there. In the story, Glaucus is transformed from a human to a kind of sea god when he jumps overboard and is inside the sea. And so Dante is suggesting that this is a kind of metaphor for the idea of transhumanization. But the interesting thing to me about the particular comparison that he uses is that when Glaucus jumps into the sea, he's sort of inside the sea and becomes part of it, rather than as a kind of outside observer looking on. And it seems to me that that's a good way of sort of piggybacking on what Bill said about the need for experience rather than simply intellectual knowledge. In fact, what's going to happen to Dante is that he's going to become part of what he sees rather than an observer looking on and describing it. And because of that, the language that is used is going to be very different from the language of Inferno, where Dante is trying to learn how to distance himself from the sins, and the language of the poet corresponds to that, where we have this kind of communal encounter in the Purgatorio, but where people still keep their own individuality. Here, Dante is sort of within and kind of part of what he is experiencing.
We need to turn now to examine the first of the souls that Dante meets in the Paradiso. This happens in the third canto. And remember, as we're ascending to the spheres, the first sphere in this Ptolemaic universe is the moon. And as it turns out, the people whom Dante meets in the sphere of the moon, again, he meets them not directly. They are in the court of heaven, as Ron has said, beyond space and time, but they condescend to appear here to Dante, are two women, both of whom are extraordinarily interesting for a number of reasons. They've done the same thing back on Earth. They have, in some ways, reneged on their vows. We probably wouldn't expect to start our discussion of paradise by meeting people who talk about things they did back on Earth that they shouldn't have done. And that's another clue that we're not just going to have kind of insipid, let's bump into holy people talking about all the holy things they did and ignoring the rest of human experience. These women, Dante talks to one, meets two. These women have indeed failed in their religious vows. They were both nuns, and they were both not fully of their own free will, but as Dante will explain, with some at least limited consent, then left the convent to engage in marriages at the behest of their male relatives who needed a political marriage and had this woman that needed to be married off in order to seal an alliance.
Yeah, now notice the larger implication to draw from that. What Dante is doing is presenting people in terms of a life that they lived back on Earth where they were not entirely faithful to their vows. It means that, for one thing, heaven is not reserved for people who led perfect lives. If so, it would be a very empty place. And in fact, what we find is in the first three spheres, not only in the first, in the sphere of the moon, in the sphere of Mercury, and in the sphere of Venus, we have, they're not sinners, of course, they're former sinners, ex-sinners. We have souls of the saved condescending to Dante, who were respectively lacking in the virtues of faith, of hope, and of love, the three Christian theological virtues. And of course, what the poet has done has associated each one of those virtues with the influence of the planet, the moon with faith because of its waxing and waning nature, and Venus, obviously, as the planet of love. Mercury, then, is associated with the virtue of hope. So, in a sense, what we have is another one of those parallels to earlier parts of the Commedia. Remember, we talked about going through the gates of the city of hell in Canto 9 and the gates of purgatory in Canto 9 of Purgatorio. In Paradiso, It's only when we get to the circle of the sun and are therefore outside of the shadow cast by the sun on Earth through the other planets that we get to see people who are associated with their sphere because of a positive virtue rather than their lack in the virtue. So a very important thing happens once again in the ninth canto of Paradiso. We'll talk about that transition later on. But just to say for now that it's another one of those cases where the structure of the three canticles is deliberately kind of placed in juxtaposition and allows us to see the way in which he's building on what's come before.
Speaking of having to go back and review Inferno and Purgatory in order to understand what's happening here in Dante's first encounter with the souls in heaven, the two people we meet are both from families where members of their family are in each of the three parts of the Commedia. We meet first a woman named Piccarda Donati. The Donati family was a Florentine family, political enemies of Dante. Cianfa Donati was in fact among the thieves in Inferno 25. Forese Donati, we talked about in our lecture on the Purgatory where Dante meets a variety of poets, and here is Piccarda. Similarly, her associate here is a woman named Constance, a Holy Roman Empress, if you will. Her son, the Emperor Frederick II, is in hell among the heretics, and her grandson, Manfred, is among the late repentant in Purgatorio 3. So we meet new faces, but old families. It tells us things about the nature of family, what families are and what families aren't. But it also is a way of Dante, with these particular characters, getting us to go back and review what we know so that we have a basis from which to learn.
Now, one of the issues that comes up with Piccarda is also sort of important in defining the whole system that the poet has laid out for us. She talks about herself, and in doing so, she recognizes the fact that she's here in the lowest sphere of Paradiso. I am Piccarda. You see me here among these other blessed, all of us within this slowest sphere, and goes on to say, our station, which appears so lowly here, has been assigned because we failed our vows to some degree and gave less than we pledged. There's a problem there. How can you have lesser and greater degrees of absolute perfection and bliss? And what she suggests is that there's a difference between what she herself is experiencing, which is kind of the maximum capacity for blessedness, and the way she shows herself to us as somebody who, in this principle of condescension, seems to have less pizzazz, less spiritual moxie than souls that we're going to see farther up. But in addition to sort of explaining this, the difference between things as they are to the eye of God and to the eye of Dante, she also suggests that everybody here is perfectly happy and perfectly content, and has one of the important and sort of famous one-liners of the poem in talking about where she is. She says, in his will is our peace. It is the sea in which all things are drawn that it itself creates, or which the work of nature makes. So that there's this suggestion that one of the defining characteristics, one of the defining qualities of Paradiso is the peace that comes from being enveloped in God's will. And so the very first figure that we see in the Paradiso tells us a good deal about what the Paradiso is all about.
And I would want to argue that that principle is important both in heaven and on earth. That is to say, what Dante really has tried to do here is find a way to reconcile things that sound to us to be irreconcilable. How do you reconcile equality and hierarchy? How can they coexist? After all, there is hierarchy on earth. There's hierarchy in the church. There's hierarchy in secular society. But there's also, and it's sort of a fundamental Judeo-Christian principle, also notions of equality. How can you reconcile those? Dante shows this in the words of Piccarda, and certainly it doesn't answer the question of how you do it on earth, but it reminds us of the issue, and it's a worldly issue as well as a theological issue.
A couple of other things that we see in these early cantos, which are important for laying out the ground rules. Dante is, as usual, not totally quick to pick things up and still has a bunch of questions. The difference here, though, is that Beatrice does a better job than Virgil did of anticipating what those questions are in advance. You have a sense that as a guide, Beatrice has a kind of knowledge and insight that was lacking in Virgil. I mean, Virgil did a good job and anticipated Dante's needs at several points along the way, but there were also places where Virgil didn't quite get it. And it seems to me that one of the differences is the way in which Beatrice is able to anticipate what Dante is thinking of. And one of the doubts she raises on behalf of Dante, she says, you've got a problem, don't you, with the fact that all of these souls here are seeming to return to their planet, as she puts it. After death, all souls seem to return each to his stars, as Plato's word affirms. In other words, what she's suggesting is that doesn't this seem like something that contradicts the Christian idea of freedom of the will if souls simply are returning to a place that they came from previously? And that whole notion of sort of the pre-existence of the soul is something that Orthodox Christianity denies anyhow. So what she says is, look, Plato really had a good insight here if you understand that what he was saying was that we have certain dispositions that are given to us by the planets. How we act on Earth turns out to be in accord with those dispositions. But of course, there's no guarantee that we act rightly or wrongly. That's where freedom comes in. So by associating us with particular planets, we're in no way denying freedom of the will. What we're simply doing is giving a useful exercise in categorizing, that this becomes a way in which we can make distinctions. And as she puts it, if he means that the honor and the blame of each sphere's influence returns to it, his arrow then has hit upon some truth. In other words, what she's saying is that it makes a whole lot of sense if you see Plato acting, thinking metaphorically here rather than thinking literally. And notice that this is another example that even though we are in paradise, we still continue to draw on and to use classical sources. Just as Bill said before, that the discussion of politics doesn't fade away because we're here. Neither does the use that the poet makes of classical sources of all kinds.
There's another issue that's also raised here with regard to Picard at Donati, and that is, hey, if you were sort of dragged away from your convent and forced to marry some guy, in Picarda's case by her brother Corso Donati, then how can you say you failed in your vows if you had no free will, if you didn't have the power to choose to stay in the convent? How can you be held in any way responsible for that? And it's a kind of complicated answer, but the simple version is ultimately the fact that we did that, we went away, we got married, and so on, means at some sense, in some sense, we consented to it. We consented in part. We may not have wanted to do it. We may have sat every day, in a sense, wishing I were back in the old convent rather than with my new hubby. But the bottom line is, did I take every possible opportunity to leave and go back? Did every time somebody's head was turned, I tried to sort of sneak out of the house, if you will? I'm kind of trivializing this to make a point. But we must realize that very often we sort of are able to convince ourselves we haven't consented to something, while in fact, in some very limited way, we have consented.
Notice, of course, this brings up the whole question of freedom of the will. We talked about it at great length in those middle sections of the Purgatorio. It turns out that freedom of the will is another one of those major issues that comes in all parts of the Commedia, and so we see it here as well.
Lecture 19. An Emperor Speaks.
In our last lecture, we introduced Paradiso by suggesting some of the ground rules, suggesting some of the ways in which it is continuous with what we saw in the Pilgrim's Journey through Inferno and Purgatorio, suggested some of the things that were new, and in the process talked about a number of cantos at the beginning where you could sort of see what the rules are by looking at the texts. We're going to do something a little bit different in this lecture by staying on one canto and one canto only. It's an intriguing canto for a lot of ways, one of which is that it is the only canto of the 100 in the entire Commedia where there is only one speaker from beginning to end. Speaker turns out to be somebody that we've already met before, the Emperor Justinian. And it also turns out to be a topic that we've met before. That is to say, we have a continuation of the theme of Inferno 6 and Purgatorio 6. In Paradiso 6, we're going to be meeting Justinian in person and talking about politics in the broadest sense.
It's worthwhile providing just a little bit of background on who this Justinian guy is, because he clearly occupies, as Ron said, a unique place in the Commedia. I'm sure many of you recall that the Roman Empire ultimately was divided in the 3rd and 4th centuries AD with two centers of power, one in the